This is Anne LeGrand, and today on Writers on Craft, I'm talking to Jessica Maxwell, the award-winning author of Roll Around Heaven, a spiritual memoir.
I'm curious, having had a really interesting career writing for magazines, mm-hmm. was it a challenge to write a spiritual memoir?
Well, not really, because I wrote it as the narrative, full-length narrative adventure that it was and still is. Wait till you read the sequel. That's after the travel books. And I used all the craft and skill from all my years of being a writer and of, you know, just doing an art form. You polish your craft, that craft to tell this story. The only thing that changed was the content. It's still an absolutely true story, just like all of my adventure stories are and will always be, unless I say I'm writing a novel now, but we're not there yet. So the challenge of it really was early on, and that's when I didn't quite know how to present it. And early on, Suzanne, I kept thinking of life and earth and adventure over here and spiritual, you know, events over here. And then it dawned on me, kind of as I said earlier, this is an adventure. I truly never know what to expect next, and neither does anyone else. It's the most original, creative, you know, kind of ongoing narrative you can imagine. And it makes fly fishing for piranha in the Amazon, which was one of my big adventures I was so excited about, look like kindergarten, this stuff. So it was just a matter of saying, oh, I get it. I need to just write this as an adventure. It's an earthbound but a spiritual adventure. And once I got that concept clear, then I knew what to do.
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of people who write books about spirituality who aren't necessarily writers.
Yeah, it's kind of they didn't spend 25 years in the literary trenches learning to be a writer. They might have fabulous ideas, scientific research or spiritual research or both these days, but that doesn't mean they can write. And one of the nice things the compliments we receive regularly is they say things like, wow, you can really write. And I'm like, well, yeah, I kind of started that way, you know. So it's unusual that an actual writer would have these kinds of experiences. And I know that's true. Or maybe it's even more unusual that an actual writer would be gutsy enough or stupid enough to write about this part of his or her life. It's a very crafted story. It wasn't written quickly. It was written with great care and a lot of attention to detail. In any art form, that pays off. So.
What did you learn 25 years in the literary trenches about writing?
Well, I came in right, I didn't know it then. This is the beauty of hindsight, but I came in right at the end of the old school of New York publishing. And when I started, I started very early as I wrote the travel column for Esquire magazine. And I had an editor there, Anita LeClaire. The sun rises and sets on her head, as far as I'm concerned. She hired, commissioned, we should say, only real writers, real literary writers, and didn't touch a word. Only once in the 10 years I wrote for her did she call up and say, you know, I'm not sure about that one word. And then I said, well, okay, we could say this. It was describing grizzly bear fur, the color of grizzly bear fur, for one of my adventure stories. When the piece was published, she had put it back to my original word. So the respect for the art of writing and for the writer, I think it's only left now in probably in the New Yorker and maybe the Atlantic, but it's just gone out the window. And I've watched that sad thing happen. I've also watched back then when I started, the editors would not allow advertisers in the editorial department. They were just a necessary evil to sell magazines. Now the advertisers are running the show. And everything has suffered because of that. It's just not art first, it's sales first. Quite often your stories you'll craft very carefully. So we end up with this situation where, you know, you might have a fabulous idea for a story. And they might say, oh, we already ran a story on, you know, Norway 5 years ago. If you had two good story, fabulous, important stories in a row on Norway, the reader would just think it was interesting. And that's all because, you know, anyone who might want to buy a cruise to Norway or whatever, they've already done it. And we're, you know, it's just the cart is leading the horse now. So I've seen that sad transformation too.
And what about craft? Has craft also suffered as a result of advertisers running the show?
Well, it's not just advertisers. Yes, it has. It's more our culture. I mean, I've taught literary nonfiction at the U of O and at the UW, University of Washington in Seattle. You know, as the years went on, you had seniors in college who did not know when to use I and me. And I would teach them the very basic rule, and they had never heard it before. They would say people that instead of people who. It's always who. And now we're seeing people that go in the New York Times. That's just basic grammar. And so I'm not being a stickler to be a stickler. It's just that, have you ever been to Madrid? Have you ever been there? Did you go see the early Picasso Museum? It's a little tiny museum. Most people don't know about it. And you go and you see his early work. It looked just like a classic European painter's work. And my point is that he had to know how to paint before he could morph it and play with it and become the Picasso we know. We leave out that whole, out of, I think, just laziness and being too fast about everything, but the whole time of really working hard to learn grammar, basic grammar. This is your mother tongue, for goodness sakes. And to learn basic craft and to really read and get those, the rhythms of the master, the master's in your inner ear, so they come out your fingertips.
Have you found any way to teach people to do that beyond learning the grammar rules?
The frustration was that I was teaching them grammar they should have learned in, you know, sixth grade when we were in college. When I really could make progress with them was when it wasn't just a term, one term. You can't do anything. I had them for a whole year. In fact, I told the administrators, I will not teach this again if you don't give me the same people for 1 year. And they go, well, if they'll sign up for a whole year. Well, we had 45 people who wanted to. So it's not that people don't want to. It's just that, and I'm not trying to diss English teachers. I think they generally do a fabulous job. It's cultural. You know, we're all texting on our cell phones and you make a spelling error, it corrects it for you. But you talk with Canadians, not even intellectual Canadians, but the old British schools. Now, there are a lot of problems with that, too. But they had higher standards, and we learned better. I was educated in California, and my sisters and I, there are real gaps because of the way things were organized. So it's a big problem. So you have to take it on yourself. If you want to be a writer, you know, have pride in your own ability to know your own language and enjoy it. And if you don't enjoy language and you don't want to work hard to learn the basics, then go be a bank teller.
Do you find that being spiritually open has affected your writing in any way?
Well, it's more the reverse. It was more looking back after I got clobbered into awareness and thinking, well, whenever I was writing, it always was like I was trying to keep up with what was coming through. I knew that. I never thought of put it in a spiritual context, but I knew that whatever I did was inspired. And what I would try to do, even back when I was teaching in the 90s, I would try to get, I did all kinds of wild things to get my students to reach their own inspiration. That's really a spiritual practice, but I didn't know it. Like I had an exercise called hot shower, cold fruit. And it just came to me that I had them write their ideas for stories they wanted to write. And then they had to go into the shower with a cold fruit, some fruit they liked that they had in the refrigerator overnight. So it was really cold. And they had to be in a hot shower eating the cold fruit. And my whole idea was just to scramble things. And of course, I had one student who said that he walked into the bathroom with a cold cantaloupe and his wife said, what in the heck are you doing? And he said, it's for inspiration. And she jumped in the shower with him and said, I'll give you some inspiration. But then after, this is how I back into everything. Afterwards, I read a brain study out of Japan back then that they were doing things like that with temperature, literally to move, to open people's creativity. Did I know? So I knew there was something that happened when I write that was so magical and so easy, unless I was emotionally upset, then it shuts down. There you go. You're stuck. You're not in your right hemisphere happy anymore. You're all, you know, contorted with negativity or worry or whatever. And so I knew that the way I wrote, because it was so natural for me, was like having, you know, a direct line to creativity. And I think creativity is spirituality. I think that's what's really going on with all of this art. In art, you know, it's the creative force that continues. It's the dance of Shiva, constantly dancing. The subatomic molecules and everything are constantly dancing. We're in constant motion. And if you tap into that, and especially when you tap into that as an artist, you can do no wrong. That's the goal. Again, you can get back to a spiritual practice will really help you to be a better artist or a better writer.
For those of you just joining us, this is KBOO Community Radio. I'm Suzanne LeGrand, and I'm talking with Jessica Maxwell today on the show Writers on Craft. What do you know about writing you didn't know when you got started?
Well, you know, when I was deciding what to do and I was in high school, I always wanted to be a doctor, but I don't have any math brain cells. So I literally at age 16, I said, well, what am I good at? And at that time, my role model was a comic strip character named Brenda Starr, who had been young and beautiful for at least 50 years at that time. And she was redhead. And I'm a redhead. And she had assignments all over the world. And she had these great clothes. And she had this really handsome, tall boyfriend named Basil St. John, I think, who had an eye patch. He was very exotic. And he would always kind of lurk. And he would, like, show up wherever she was, which actually would be a little annoying if you thought of it. But it seemed romantic at the time. And so I thought, I'm going to be Brenda Starr. Now, what they don't show you in the comic strip was how hard you have to work to be Brenda Starr, because I was almost never a staff writer. I always wanted to be independent. I wrote for many different magazines. I had long-term relationships with many different editors. Those guys were not intimidated or upset by the fact that I'm a girl. They thought it was cool because, and I figured it out, their idea for themselves is that they're financial guys. So I want to go fly fishing for piranha in the Amazon. They just thought that was cool. But the boys club, I don't know, I stepped on a few toes or something. I'm not sure what happened there, but it never really worked. But Forbes would let me do anything I wanted. But the thing is, as an independent writer, I had to reinvent the wheel almost every time I sold a story. Now, once you have a working relationship with an editor, like Anita LeClaire at Esquire, she used to call me up. This is up until almost till 2000. And she would say, well, where do you want to go next? And I would say, well, I was thinking about this story. And she'd say, that sounds great. Do it. I never in 10 years had a contract. I never had a problem, and I was paid within 2 weeks of submission. Now it is a year. The last big feature I did, it took from February, it took about a year to be paid. And, you know, if you don't have another means of making a living or a husband who's willing to, you know, take care of the finances so you can be an artist, you're in trouble now. That's another sad, sad part of it, and it's part of not being respected. So back then, when I went into it, it was all not just romance, because I'm a real hard worker. I've never have been a slacker. But I didn't realize how proportionately you probably spend 80% of your energy just getting the assignment and then doing the travel. And then you have that much left over, 20%, to do the actual work. it's proportionate about like that to each even get an assignment. And it still was really exhausting. You know, I loved it so much I would get up and go at it again. It allowed me to see the world and to have this vast bank reservoir of experiences that I can now draw on for all sorts of things. But I didn't know how hard it would be. And then what has shifted, it's not only how difficult it is just to be respected and work with editors now, it's also because of the computer, I think, they rewrite you. The respect, even for a crafted, polished, established, well-known, quote-unquote successful writer, they will mess with you. And I have fly fishing buddies, older gentlemen. The other called me up a few years ago and he said, "You want to go fishing with John McPhee?" And I said, "The John McPhee, the New Yorker John McPhee?" He said, "Yeah, you want to go? We'll stay at your house. You cook us dinner. We'll all go fishing." This was when we were living in Eugene, and we went. So I am fishing on the Mackenzie River sitting next to John McPhee. I couldn't even cast. I couldn't do anything. And so at one point I was talking to John McPhee about editors these days, and I told him I was having this problem with an editor who didn't used to do that to me. And he would not only rewrite me miserably but inaccurately, and my name's on it. And John McPhee stopped mid-cast, and he looked at me, and he said, "This must be nipped in the bud." And he said, "I have had that happen, and you have to stop it immediately." And I said, "Oh, my God, if they are editing, if they're rewriting John McPhee, it's over." That's where we've become. That's where we've come. And he did say, when, you know, I hope someday to write for The New Yorker. It's my goal as a magazine writer. He said, "They won't do that to you. That I can promise you." But that's the only place.
So what advice would you give to writers who want to learn how to write well?
Read the classics. Don't be too swift to want to be published, be in the big time. I was still at the U of O in journalism school, and I wasn't even out of school yet, and I wrote a proposal to the editor of Los Angeles Magazine, so a city magazine. And he took my story. He liked the idea. When I graduated a few months later, I moved home just to have a place. I didn't know what to do yet. And I made a meeting with him, and I went, and I had 3 pages of ideas, story ideas, and he chose 7. And I wrote for Los Angeles Magazine for the next year. Once I had those clips, you know, we still call them clips in print, then I took them to, I think it was California Magazine back then, a state magazine. And then I started writing for them, did some wonderful, they had real editors there. And then I parlayed those to airlines magazines, in-flight magazines. And then once, you know, I just leapfrogged very slowly, with the idea that I was heading for New York and nobody could stop me, but I also had to be good enough. And John McPhee told me he tried to write for The New Yorker. I think he told me it took him, 10 or 15 years before he was accepted. And he said they were right. I wasn't good enough. And so part of the problem with our culture and with mastery of anything is we don't understand that you have to fall in love with the plateau. And I have that same quote that I just said in Roll Around Heaven for spiritual practice. The plateau is where you're going to live. You have to be in love with the practice itself, whether it's the practice of writing, the practice of trying to create story ideas and sending them out there. You can't be only in love with the results. And so that deep patience with the process itself and with yourself as a developing artist, that is what's going to see you through. We don't teach patience in this culture, far from it. And I just heard over the weekend somebody, it was just a few days ago, someone told me that the research is in, she's in education, that we kind of have been thinking that the generation that is now tweeting and texting and cell phoning nonstop. I mean, you're here with these friends, you're texting the friends over there, you're with those friends, you're texting the friends over here. Nobody's ever present. And we've been saying, well, they're adapting. Their brains are different now. They're not. The research is in. It doesn't work. So you have to make a choice. The beauty of a meditation practice is that you start your day anchoring yourself in stillness, in peace, and in presence. And I have a really good friend who's a neighbor, actually, who's an acupuncturist, and she calls acupuncture enforced meditation. You cannot get up off the table for half an hour. And she said a lot of people can't stand it. And in yoga, I practice yoga, and I think it's asana, I'm sorry, but it's the final pose where you're just resting. And all of the chi and the blood and the lymph that you've been moving around with all these postures are now flooding in, not to mention endorphins, all through your body. And all the yoga teachers I've studied with have said it's the hardest posture for most people. And I'm like, are you kidding? You get to just lie there and just relax. So it's very hard for us to unplug. And we're paying for it with exhausted adrenals, crummy craft, poor health, you know, and relationships that don't last because nobody's present and nobody's really going deep. And I guess, you know, back to your question, I didn't know. I was too young when I started. I was really young, just went right for it and never stopped. That's all I've ever done is write. I didn't know how long it really took to master your craft. I mean, I always worked really hard and, you know, had a natural knack for it. But I remember 7 years into nonstop magazine writing, suddenly sitting there and thinking, I know how to do this. It was seat of my pants until then, kind of intuitive and kind of hard work combined and a little talent thrown in there that I was polishing. But it was at that point that I knew what I was doing, at least to write a magazine story. And there's this marvelous book. Everyone who wants to be a writer or anything, wants to master anything, should read it. It's by George Leonard, I think his name is, and it's called Mastery. And he's the one who said you have to fall in love with the plateau. And he's an Aikido master, a martial arts master and teacher in Sausalito, I think. And he talked about these guys who would come in and they've bought all the gear and they want a black belt tomorrow. They're so goal-oriented. They're always out there somewhere, never right here. And then there's that wonderful Buddhist, I think it's Koan is what they're called. And if I might have it a little wrong, but it's basically that the terrible horse is the horse that won't move until the pain of the whip sinks into its bones. And the poor horse won't move until it feels the sting of the whip. And the good horse will start to move when it hears the whip in the air, but the excellent horse will run just for the love of running. Or from, they will say, for the love of the rider, which they would say is your Buddha nature or God or whatever. And so you want to be an excellent horse. If you want to be an excellent artist, you want to write for the joy of writing. You want to, and if you do that, that keeps you present in the presence of the being a writer itself, you know, the act of being a writer itself. And it's staying there over and over, year after year after year, that you will look up someday and realize you really know what you're doing, you have a voice, and you're ready to go to the big time.
I've been talking with Jessica Maxwell, who's won 2 Gold Awards for her book, Roll Around Heaven, a spiritual memoir. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you.
This has been Writers on Craft, a show about writing and the creative process, produced by KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM. For program notes or to listen to a podcast of this show, go to kboo.fm online or visit our website at www.writersoncraft.com.